Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. And even though it's Canada, it is the morning of July the 4th, Monday, July 4th, 2022, which is Independence Day in the United States, a day that Americans are asking, what does my citizenship mean to me? And what does my country mean to me? And as always, because it's Monday, I'm joined with Jimmy Sexton, the CEO of the Esquire Group in Dubai, and we are continuing working through the lessons of the great book, Charles Adams, For Good and Evil: The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. Well, Jimmy, they have a 4th of July in Dubai as well, do they?
They have their Independence Day, which I believe is which is in December, but it's not one day of fireworks. They celebrate their National Day for a month.
All right. Sounds like that would be, yeah, that's in December, you say.
Yeah,
Sounds like that would be a good month to visit Dubai.
it is.
So it's also been a long weekend in Canada. July 1st is Canada Day, so this is what, 4 or 5 days of celebrating country, I guess, isn't it? Celebrating country, patriotism, history, all those things. And purely coincidentally, we are on lesson 22, which says patriotism is soluble in oppressive taxation, oppression in the rates of tax, or in the manner in which taxes are assessed or collected. What a perfect topic for July the 4th. Again, patriotism is soluble in oppressive taxation, oppression in the rates of tax, or in the manner in which taxes are assessed or collected. Well, taking that apart, what are your thoughts on that?
I think just as this sentence, patriotism is soluble in oppressive taxation, that is such a beautifully written sentence. It is so concise and so accurate, that I think it's 100% true. I mean, I'm sure that you have experienced this with your clients. I mean, this is especially been true in with clients that I know, especially from Europe. I know so many like dual citizen Americans that we're getting nothing from America, just incurring fees for having their tax returns prepared, but would absolutely not expatriate because it would be unpatriotic. But then, a couple years later, after having done a streamlined procedure to get into compliance and having gone through a few years of having to file taxes and be in compliance, their patriotism dissolved in oppressive taxation, and they expatriated.
It's fascinating to me that you gave that precise example, right? Which is to take that apart a little bit. Presumably, an American citizen abroad who didn't realize there was citizenship taxation said, "My God, it's my patriotic duty to file taxes," did a streamline, and then a few years later expatriated. And I've got to tell you, Jimmy, that that is exactly my experience with people. Now, as you know, I'm not a tax preparer, but I do get calls from time to time with people saying, "Oh my God, how do I get into tax compliance? I didn't realize about this." And I'd say, "Well, all right, I'll refer you here, I'll refer you there, and they'll take care of you." And what I'm really thinking is, and they're, "Thanks, John, great, et cetera." But what I'm thinking and not saying to them is, "You'll be back to me in about 5 years wanting to renounce." And that happens like clockwork. I mean, it is extraordinary.
And I think that that is exactly what this sentence says: oppression in the rates of tax or in the manner in which taxes are assessed or collected. And I think it's that latter part, assessed or collected, what's exactly happening with these Americans abroad. Because you're absolutely right. I would say that probably a good 70%, 60 to 70% of the clients that I've had that went through a streamline and got in compliance and then went through that rigmarole for a few years, eventually said, you know what, this isn't worth it.
Well, I think the problem is, I mean, the whole act of compliance is, of course, a gigantic problem, you know, if they even can comply in the sense that, you know, with certainty of what they're doing. But the bigger problem is the restrictions that U.S. tax compliance put on their capacity, their ability to do responsible financial planning in the country where they actually live. Well, right?
I mean, for sure. I mean, look, I can't speak for every country in Europe, but I certainly know Austria, Germany, and several other, I think France and several other countries, you know, as an American living abroad, you can get a regular old bank account, the equivalent to like a checking account and savings account that bears interest, but you can't invest in any sort of saving arrangements or private pension arrangements or get a brokerage account. None of that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're allowed what are called depository accounts, you know, your basic, you know, whatever. But the anything beyond that is unquestionably a problem. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, even if you can get the accounts, you know, then the question is, well, you know, how does a middle class person, you know, invest for retirement, whatever? And, you know, we've got the problem of mutual funds, unless they're bought in the United States or, you know, various things that in actuality are pension plans in the country where they live and not treated that way by the U.S., for example, small business corporations, et cetera. So, I mean, this is, you know, it's a huge problem.
Well, and this isn't necessarily, this is a little off topic for a second, but and not necessarily related directly to individuals, but it's on my mind because it happened today that I had a client call me this morning because they're establishing a new banking relationship and are fighting with the bank over the FATCA classification of one of the entities. And they have tax opinions. I think they have three tax opinions on this FATCA tax classification. There is not a U.S. person involved in the entire structure. Right. So these guys have probably spent 30,000 euros on tax opinions of what the proper FATCA classification is for this entity. And now they're fighting it with a bank for absolutely no reason. Like there's not a single American involved in the structure. It's absolutely incredible. The amount of wasted effort that FATCA has put on people and businesses.
Oh, I mean, it is an absolutely extraordinary thing. And I'm wondering the way you describe that, if perhaps that wasn't related to the whole CRS classification as well.
It was for both.
It was the whole, the whole thing, yeah. Because they're using, they're using a common form, right? Is that correct for both of them or were they separate?
Well, most of the banks have now created their own sort of common forms that cover both. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you get into these issues of investment entities and holding companies and stuff like this, and whether it's a passive NFFE or active, if it has active subsidiaries, for example, it just gets super complex and there's not always a very clear answer. And so everybody's got their own.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something, an observation on that. There's an unlimited number of continuing education courses on this type of stuff. Right. And a few months ago, I saw for at least the first time I remember somebody offering a course in that exactly how to fill out these bank forms, you know, when you're opening an account. And, you know, I mean, the fact that somebody would perceive a clear demand for that, you know, how to fill out a form to open a bank account. I mean, to me, just suggest that this thing has, you know, it's now completely over the top in terms of its bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, you know, just a horrible, horrible impediment. You know, again, before we get back to the topic, now your comment, you know, makes me think of something recently. You know, I've done a few podcasts with these with people who are promoting this fair tax initiative. You know, which essentially would turn the United States into a territorial system of based on a consumption tax. And, you know, everybody's making the argument in terms of, well, you know, we'll raise the same money and this, that, and the other thing. I think that's good, but I don't think that's the argument at all. I think the argument is that it frees people from all this incredible bureaucracy, right?
For sure. I mean, look, I mean, you and I have talked about it a little bit before, but yeah, I mean, that's one of the really nice things. One of the big things that I noticed after expatriating, and it actually took a couple years to sink in, that like I don't need to follow what's tax deductible, what's not tax deductible, and you know, living in Dubai and not constantly having to think about tax and compliance and what I have to file this and blah 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 blah. It's extremely freeing. Like I, you know, wasn't my motivation for expatriating but after having done it, it wasn't even something I was paying attention to. I just kind of noticed that when they'd hand you receipts at places, you kind of be like, oh, I've no necessity for this.
A very pleasant byproduct. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, for people who, you know, stop drinking, for example, you know, yeah, all the unanticipated benefits in their life, right? Or they, you know, get on an exercise program and, oh my God, you know, it did this for me as well, et cetera. I mean, there's no question that the culture of compliance and bureaucracy is, you know, the same way that alcohol is toxic to people's lives, this culture of compliance, bureaucracy, and cost is so toxic to human freedom, to human progress. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable. But, you know, of course, when we talk about this, Jimmy, we're, you know, each preaching to the converted, so to speak. There are people who don't see it this way.
So I want to go back to this concept of patriotism, because I absolutely do believe, you know, everybody has their price, and at some point, you know, patriotism stops in favor of not having to pay taxes or not having to.
What do you think patriotism even is?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think patriotism is a love of your country, but I don't necessarily think that means, you know, a love or respect of your government. I think it's...
Well, let me just pause you on that for a second, because, you know, it's July the 4th, and I think that we should pay tribute to a great American writer, Mark Twain.
Okay.
Do you remember what his comment was about patriotism?
I do not.
Okay, well, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but you get the gist of it. I mean, this was, like many things coming from Mark Twain, was absolutely brilliant, okay? He put it exactly the way you apply. He said, you know, patriotism is love of country always and loyalty to the government when it deserves it.
Yep. I think that is a fantastic quote. And I know you read the New York Times, and I want to ask you, did you read this article? I think it was last week, called America the Merciless.
No, I didn't. Tell me about it. You should send
okay.
it to me.
I'm going to forward this to you. But I'm going to read you this one. I'm not going to give you the context, but I'm going to read you this paragraph because there's a couple of statistics in here I think you'll find interesting. I'm going to read you part of the paragraph. It would be inaccurate in any case to pin these policies entirely on the American people when polls suggest that most wouldn't choose these arrangements. A majority of Americans, 72% as of 2018, support euthanasia, which is illegal in most of the United States, and 65% in all the United States, I think, and 65% as of 2018 support physician-assisted suicide. Around 6 in 10 Americans believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases. And My question, because I think this quote from Mark Twain is very good, the government when it deserves it. As I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, how did America get to a point, the supposed beacon of freedom and democracy in the world, which we've already discussed are not the same thing, where it's no longer a government of the people, it's a government of the representatives. The government, the people obviously have nothing to say. They're electing representatives and they're doing exactly what they want, whatever they want, regardless of what the people want. And I always thought that this was, that this is the first time I've seen statistics on stuff like this, but I know even on stuff like when, before gay marriage became legal, almost every single person I talked to was in favor of it. But how in the hell was it not legal? You know?
Well,
So going to what Mark Twain's saying, you know, listen, when the government doesn't deserve it, expatriate. That's the ultimate sign of patriotism.
Well, I think you're right. I could recommend for anybody, for listeners, and very interesting book came out a few years ago by Lucy Saylor called Under the Starry Flag, which, you know, is essentially a book about the history of expatriation in the United States, which is fascinating. Okay. But, you know, the way you describe the article reminds me a little bit of, President Reagan's 1981 inaugural speech, where, I mean, you really ought to have a look at this because there's so much in there. There's so many. We ought to do a series of podcasts on that speech, you know, going through it sort of paragraph by paragraph.
It's the 81 inaugural speech, right?
1981. Yeah.
81, okay.
For you, ancient history. For me, a long time ago, but still in my life. but in any case, very early on in the speech, he says something like, let us take stock. We are a people who has a government, not the other way around. We are a people who has the government, not the other way around. And it seems pretty clear when you read that excerpt from the article in the Times that, in fact, what has happened now is the United States is a government that has a people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's extremely tyrannical. Yeah, it's extremely tyrannical. Now, it may be that this is the natural sort of evolution of democracy, you know, before these things sort of, you know, collapse under their own weight. But, you know, I've said this for a long time. People think I'm kidding. It's not intended to be humorous. I mean, I think that the Internal Revenue Code has replaced the Constitution as the governing document in the United States. I mean, I think it's a huge problem. But, you know, there are signs of a possible reversal. For example, I hadn't read this till somebody mentioned it to me. This case last week, West Virginia on EPA.
Yeah.
Have a look at this. I mean, I haven't read it in great, great detail, although I started to read one of the decisions. But at a minimum, what it means is there are limits on what regulatory agencies can do.
Yep.
It means that at a minimum. And that is a great, great move forward, I think.
So now let me ask you this question, because I also read, you know, an article last week, as I'm sure you saw it, as we all knew it was going to happen, that the repatriation tax was constitutional. So,
sorry, you repeat that? The what?
The 965 tax was constitutional. The repatriation, you know.
Okay,
the tax
where did you see this?
It was. I read it in New York Times, and I read it in Bloomberg. So there was a challenge as to its constitutionality. It was upheld.
Was this the Moore case? Do you remember the name?
It might have been. I forget the title of the case.
Okay.
But the point that I wanted to say is this. I think it is good, obviously, that, you know, this EPA thing is definitely a blow against overregulation. But do you think that the court has the balls to stand up to the tax code and regulation for that, given that that's how their salaries are paid.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I do. I think this particular court does. I mean, this is kind of interesting because I know that the current composition of the court is general, has, I think, been the subject of a lot of ridicule recently in that. But, you know, what the court is doing actually is beginning a pathway towards what I would say a discussion about the role of the courts, you know, the role of the Constitution and this sort of stuff. And I think that some of the decisions, particularly by Justice, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Gorsuch?
I don't know.
Anyway, he's one of the newer ones, are very, very interesting, very interesting, you know, decisions and kind of, you know, but I would not be surprised if at least this particular court would be less deferential to, you know, Treasury regulations. But, you know, who's to know? I mean, one of the things is that, and I don't think this is good, but these U.S. Supreme Court justices are lifetime appointments, aren't they?
Yep. I mean, that's every federal judge, right? Is a lifetime.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, I think that's a really tough thing to decide whether or not that's a good call or not, right? Because the whole idea behind the lifetime appointment is that they don't have to worry about getting shit canned if they make a decision somebody doesn't like.
Well, yeah, this is of course, you know, it's like everything, you know, is both good and bad. I think probably mandatory retirement at a certain age might make more sense.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be a particularly young age, but I think it, you know, provides a certain predictability. But you know, we're definitely living in tumultuous times. They're interesting, and I think a lot of the very basic principles of what it means to live in a liberal democracy are being reconsidered.
But you know, one of the things that I want to go back to is this concept of patriotism, because, and I don't know how it is in Canada, but the United States is the only country that I know of where people feel that it would somehow be unpatriotic to expatriate. I mean, me as an ex-American, I still consider myself very, very patriotic, but I'm just not a citizen anymore. But it's interesting, like within Europe, for example, I know so many people that change their country of residence. And a lot of times, if they've lived in one country for a long time, that's another EU country, they'll take on that citizenship just because that's the country that they're living in. That's where they plan to stay. And so to them, it makes sense that they're then a country of that citizen. And nobody calls them unpatriotic for giving up their Austrian citizenship to become German or Spanish or whatever. And I mean, I know people from all over the world that have changed their citizenships and never given a second thought as to the implications as far as patriotism. And I really feel like this is something that's very unique to America. You know, because we got to pledge allegiance to the flag every morning.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it is unique. I think it is unique to America. And, you know, the last 10 years ago or so, you know, has caused me to, you know, think about this and to realize that citizenship does mean different things in different countries. So, for example, you know, when somebody becomes a Canadian citizen, I mean, I've been to, you know, occasionally Canadian citizenship ceremonies. It's, you know, welcome to Canada. You know, you're, you know, now entitled to the rights of being a Canadian, you know, this sort of stuff generally. And of course, there's the ceremonial swearing allegiance to Canada and the Queen. And I mean, technically, Canada is still a British colony. Okay. Yeah. As is, I think, Australia. You compare that to the U.S. thing. Now, also, there's nothing in becoming Canadian where you have to say, you know, mouth, I'm renouncing other citizenships, you know, this sort of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But if you count American, I mean, first of all, what is that e pluribus something or other from the many one, from the many one? Okay, in other words, you're becoming symbolically a part of this whole, right? A part of this whole. And the whole, I think, is largely to preach the gospels of American superiority, et cetera, et cetera. So I agree with you that I would not call, I mean, this is like baked in to what it means to be an American, from the point of naturalization, or in our case, from the point of birth, growing up with a Pledge of Allegiance, in school and stuff like that. But definitely not all citizenships are the same in terms of how they in terms of how they see themselves. You said something else that was very interesting. I mean, here's a conversation I've had with a lot of people who are expatriating, and this is on the, the sort of loyalty issue, right? This sense of, and it's that exactly. I feel like I'm giving up something. I feel like I'm not being patriotic. And what I say to them is, the same way you said it a moment ago, you're always going to be an American. If you want to be an American, you're always going to be you're just not a citizen.
And you know what? I'll tell you something really that's perplexed me over the years has been I become more patriotic the longer I've not been a citizen. And it's something that I've often given a lot of thought to. And even people that know me used to say, oh, you used to not have a nice real thing to say about America. Now, it's kind of like this great place that you talk about. And I think sort of being freed of its government, I feel like when you're in their system, you're just constantly berated by some kind of regulation or something that just is really a damper on your life. And then when you get out of it, it really allows you to kind of appreciate America for what it is. So I've find that my patriotism is increases as time goes on.
That's interesting. That's an interesting observation. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if for no other reason but that people who've never been American citizens or never lived in the United States have a completely different image of what America is. I mean, it is closer to sort of the, what was it, Romney? Who was it who came up with the shiny city on the hill? Was that Mitt Romney?
I don't remember.
Or somebody or other, right?
Your screen's jumping, John. Your screen's jumping around, just so
Oh,
you know.
sorry. So, we go back to the Reagan speech, right? I think a second thing, and you really ought to go locate the speech and think about it, because we ought to do a couple of
I
podcasts.
pulled it up on YouTube already, so when we're done, I'm gonna watch it
Well,
tonight.
he also talks about freedom and the dignity of the individual has been more available here than in any other country, right? Now, this is another interesting thing, and when we look at the whole tax and regulatory system, right, I disagree. I disagree. I mean, I think the country is run by regulations, tax code, et cetera.
I mean, listen, I spend, as you know, I've spent a lot of time in Europe. I've spent a lot of time in Dubai. And I would say that there are other places in the world, I mean, especially within Europe, where the individual has far more freedoms than in the United States. I have a good friend of mine used to go to the US, used to go on vacation there every year. And he stopped about 10 years ago because he goes, from the second I enter the country till the second I leave, I constantly feel anxious that I'm going to get in trouble for something. And I'm not even doing anything wrong. And so he stopped going because of the anxiety. Another friend of mine was taking a trip recently, and he actually took a more inconvenient flight route just to avoid having a layover in the United States because he didn't want to deal with immigration. So,
Well, that tells you a lot. I think part of the problem is, right, you say, well, worried about doing something wrong. I think a big part of the problem here is that nobody even knows what's wrong in America anymore. I mean, you know, there's so many laws, there's 50 states, laws, regulations. But I mean, it's bad enough to have all these things, but nobody even understands what they say.
No.
You know, read the Internal Revenue Code, for example. I mean, I will freely admit that I understand almost none of it when I read it the first time. I understand the penalty provision. You know, I understand that you're going to get a fine for, you know, not doing something. But it's never entirely clear on what it is you have to do, right?
No. And, you know, what's really interesting about what you're saying is it made me think back to you know, my childhood in the United States. And, you know, even as a kid, like, you understand, like, you have the right to remain silent. Like, you know, the police can't come in your house without a warrant. Like, you know, you start from movies and from other kids and stuff like this. You sort of get this a lot of times inaccurate. But I feel like the people in America, through this indirect sort of legal education, are much more aware of the things that are not allowed than when you're in other countries. Like in Europe, you know, nobody really worries about it because pretty much everything's allowed, right? Like, if you drink a beer on the street in Austria, you're not going to jail. You know, you do that other than maybe Las Vegas, you know, you got a big problem on your hands. And I know a lot of Europeans that have gotten in trouble for this, right? Or drinking a bottle of wine on the beach in California, which is, you know, not allowed. But who would guess that if you're not, you know, if you're from Europe where you can have a drink anywhere?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting problem. And then, of course, another thing that I think is, I think I'm right in saying this. But anyway, the general principle is that different rules apply to different classes of people. Because let's take a look at, for example, somebody who's in the U.S. on a green card. All right. Yeah. Now, so some states, you know, I hope what I'm saying is accurate. I think it's accurate, but it's not off by much. Okay. If it's off, you know, so some states, for example, allow smoking, you know, the use of marijuana, right? But if that violates a federal law, right? So somebody who is a citizen, you know, could make use of marijuana, what have you. But somebody who is a green card holder would be putting their green card in jeopardy, right?
For sure.
So it's really quite interesting in that not only do you have the complexity, but there's another layer of complexity, right, which depends on, you know, who you are from an immigration point of view.
I never thought about it that way, but you're absolutely correct.
Yeah. I mean, this is really problematic, right? And I think that explains in large part why people are so anxious. And also, by the way, and this is also true in Canada, I think the principal reason that permanent residents in Canada, green card holders in the U.S. become citizens is often to avoid the risk of possible deportation.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, it makes sense. But, you know, on this slightly off topic, maybe we save this for another thing, for another podcast, but I'll tell you what's an interesting thing that I found with all of this marijuana being legal, and, you know, now mushrooms have become legal in some states, is, you know, from an estate planning standpoint, so many people put substance abuse provisions or the use of, you know, provisions prohibiting the use of illegal drugs in their trusts. And then when you think about that, illegal where? Right? Like, if you live in California, okay, recreational use of marijuana is legal in California, but if it's not specified in the trust, are you talking about an illegal drug for California purposes, for federal purposes? And is it the governing law of where, for example, the trust was established, or where the individual is located at the time they use the drug?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Jesus.
And it's a super interesting thing that over the last few years as the laws are changing in Europe and the United States and Canada around all this stuff, when you get into the estate planning, I think it's something that a lot of people miss. They still have these old provisions in their trusts, you know, and it's not so clear cut anymore.
I think that's absolutely right. And then on the, you know, the issue of shifting laws, I mean, I think we'd be remiss in not pointing out, you know, the overturning of Roe versus Wade thing, where now we're going to have a patchwork of, you know,
Oh,
abortion
yeah, for sure.
rights and things like that in the United States, which is an interesting, you know, another interesting problem. I mean, you know,
For sure.
the idea of an American moving from one state to another because, you know, a certain conduct is legal in one state but not another. I mean, that just strikes me as kind of odd, don't you think?
For sure. And you know, and now I don't know if you read this, but I read on that topic that now Google, if they see that one of your trips was to an abortion clinic, they're deleting your history.
I did see that. Was that the New York Times?
I think so.
Yeah, I did see
that. First ethical thing Google's ever done.
Yeah, probably true. Probably true. You remember in the early years of Google, wasn't their motto "Do no evil"?
Yeah, something like that. They botched that one.
Yeah. I wonder if that was ever even aspirational. But yeah, the world has definitely changed.
You know, my experience has always been, if somebody has to point out what they are, that's probably what they're not.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. Interesting. Well, let's see here. So patriotism, July the 4th. So what do you think about the whole issue of renunciations then?
Well, I think I would revise this sentence a little bit. And I wouldn't say patriotism is soluble. I would say that citizenship is. Because I think you can still be very patriotic. But I think even patriotism at a certain point might stop with enough oppressive taxation.
I think it could. You know, it's interesting. You know, the when you renounce the what's called the name and shame list, you know, your name appears on this list. You know,
sometime.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, or sooner or later or something like that. You know what's fascinating about that? What would be the mindset of a Congress or a legislator who would even think to put something like that into law? I mean, why is it so important to publicly name people who renounce U.S. citizenship? What does that tell you about the concept of U.S. citizenship?
Well, I mean, look, I kind of think there's two ways to look at it. I'm of the same opinion as you that it is a name and shame list. But you could also argue that it's sort of the equivalent of a legal notice, right? I mean, there's also kind of, right, if you can't serve somebody within a certain amount of time, you publish it in the newspaper. If there's a foreclosure on a house, you publish it in the newspaper. And, you know, you could make an argument that, you know, if a bank had somebody incorrectly classified as an American, you know, and they didn't read the list, that you could argue that, hey, you were on notice. It was your responsibility, right? Which I don't think they've ever done. But my thought process would be, if I had to play devil's advocate, that would be my argument for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that would be an argument for it. I don't know that it's a great argument for it.
I agree with you. I think it's a name and shame list.
No, I think it was clearly designed to, you know, embarrass, to try to humiliate, etc. But again, you know, it's this notion of, you know, somehow no longer wanting to be a U.S. citizen is some form of treachery, dishonesty.
For sure.
Unpatrioticness or, you know, or something like that, which is very, you know, very odd kind of thing. I mean, I don't think other than, you know, as a matter of interest for people who are thinking about expatriating, I wonder if anybody even looks at the list. And of course, we know it's not accurate anyway, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll tell you what I've found interesting is not a single person that I've ever talked to that has been aware of my expatriation. Whether a homegrown American living in America or an American abroad or anybody else has ever called me unpatriotic or why in the hell would you do that or something else. you know, some people have been like, you know, oh, I wish I had the confidence to do that or something like that. But nobody's ever said a bad thing. I think a lot of this is just in people's heads that it's unpatriotic. I don't think.
Oh,
don't
it is. It is. It is. I mean, I think that the particular flavor of patriotism that seems to be baked into U.S. citizenship is, I think, closer to a cult, you know, than it is to, you know, any rational identification with membership in a community.
Yep.
But it does make clear that not all citizenships are the same. You know, I think there's no doubt about that.
100%. I mean, like I said before, I think the U.S. citizenship is the only citizenship that I'm aware of that has this emotional attachment to it.
Or at least the degree of emotional attachment, yeah.
Correct, yeah.
I mean, do you think that for people who are Americans, presumably you would think that it's a larger and more defining part of their identity than perhaps citizens of, you're what, a German citizen, I think, or Canadian, or?
I mean, look, I think absolutely, and I'll give you an example. So I didn't start going to school in the United States until I was in fifth grade. And I remember coming into the fifth grade in the United States, having, you know, gone to school before that in Europe. And I just couldn't understand this Pledge of Allegiance thing. I was like, this is insane. And to be honest with you, it made me feel very uncomfortable. Like, you know, you're just blindly pledging allegiance to a flag for what? Like, it was really weird to me. And even now, like, you know, because you see it in the movies, like, from time to time, somebody will ask me, like, is this real? Do you guys really do this every morning? And I, yeah. And they're blown away.
Do you remember the Pledge of Allegiance? Could you say it now?
Oh, let's see. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, undivided and indivisible for all.
Under God, indivisible, or something like that.
Yeah, pretty close, though. Yeah, I mean, listen, I haven't said that.
Jimmy, that's impressive.
And it's been probably more than 30 years since I've said it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Apparently, the words of the Pledge of Allegiance have evolved over the years.
Okay.
You know, I don't do a search on this. I think you'll find that. But what is most notable about it is, and the reason I think it's cult-like, is because it's not allegiance to any kind of principle. It's simply an allegiance to the, you know, to the U.S. government. It's basically all it is, right?
For sure.
I mean, it's the equivalent of, you know, Congress writing a regulation. The IRS can do anything it wants and we'll support it.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, 100%.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been, I think, a great 4th of July discussion.
For sure. Very timely.
And to be clear, in the same way that Reagan in his speech said, it is not my intention to get rid of the government. I think that we'll probably close by saying it is not our intention to disparage the United States on this day.
Absolutely not.
Et cetera. So let me just read the lesson in again before we close. I think it's an amazing coincidence that, you know, we're doing this on July the 4th, but
sure.
Patriotism is soluble in oppressive taxation. Oppression in the rates of tax or in the manner in which taxes are assessed or collected. Wow, this guy was way ahead of his time, for sure.
He for sure was.
Jimmy, how would people get a hold of you to get some of that Sexton wisdom?
EsquireGroup.com or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com.
All right, great discussion today. Looking forward to next Monday morning.